and welcome to Afashin podcast. In this podcast, we welcome guests who are waging a struggle. My name is Frederike Geerdink. I'm a journalist who writes and speaks about power structures and those who want to tear them down. This podcast is powered by Media News, which you can visit at medianews.net. Let me explain why this podcast is called Afashin, meaning blue water. Afashin is a region in the mountains of Kurdistan, where the river by the same name has its source. The Afashin is clear, blue, and sparkling, and an inspiration for the Kurdish struggle for freedom. This is the third episode of Afashin podcast. I'm honored to welcome Nadja Duhacek as my guest. Nadja lives in Belgrade, Serbia, and is part of the Women in Black feminist group. Welcome as my guest. My first question to you would be, what is the source of your struggle? Where did it all begin for you?
So thank you for the invitation and for organizing a space to talk about these really, really important topics. I was honored to listen to the previous podcasts. When it comes to the source of my struggle, and I guess of many, many women and men who were born in Yugoslavia, but then witnessed in many different ways the wars and its violent breakup. I think part of the answer is always the question that we kept going back to, which was why did it have to end up in a war? Why did it have to end up in so much violence? And part of our answer was always the idea that we need to actually start building peace, and that peace cannot just be an idea of going back to something, because the society that we had before the wars was also patriarchal. And part of the struggle is to actually not just build peace, but to build a better peace that will be good for women. And that we have to understand that we are actually not fighting just the physical violence itself and the armed struggle that is going on, but also the warmongering that happens before, the hatred that is actually built into the values before one bullet is shot. So in a nutshell, that is part of the story. Women in Black are a feminist and anti-militarist group. Mm-hmm. So part of the work is always dismantling both violence and patriarchy and hierarchies in whatever shape or form they come. But it also has to do with just being a space where you can connect with people who share your values.
How did your personal involvement start? When did you think like, oh, these women in black, I have to be a part of that? Was there a certain moment that you thought, yes, now I have to get involved?
For me personally, the time was, so Women in Black started in November of 1991. Personally, I was 10 at that time. Hmm. And I was glad to know that they existed when I was a teenager. But when after I graduated, I was privileged to study abroad. When I was 24, I moved back to Belgrade, and I was very much interested. That was in the year 2005. I was very interested to actually see what kinds of peace initiatives are still going on. And after I met and started working with Women in Black, my personal connection was trying to rethink the 90s and the wars and the dominant narratives, which are unfortunately still present. But that was also my entry into feminism, because like many, I think, middle-class women, I thought that this was not necessarily the priority. I thought that this was something that somebody else had won before and we could just enjoy. But actually meeting feminists and working with them made me also realize that I had so much to learn still. And that it was an ongoing struggle and that none of it was actually finished.
What kind of narratives are you talking about?
So the dominant narratives in Serbia, unfortunately, some of them are even gaining strength these days, are that this was a war that had nothing to do with us, or that this was a war where we were attacked and we are the victims, that there is nothing to be gained from rethinking responsibility, that as a state, even if we understand that crimes were committed, we should not actually talk about our responsibility. We should only talk about, for example, Serbian victims. Some of these nationalist narratives are unfortunately very present in now neighboring countries. But one of the things that I have learned from Women in Black is that we need to start from ourselves. We need to start from the group that we belong to, and we need to critically evaluate what has been done in our name. And this is actually a starting point. I don't know how many of the stories that I can tell you now have been in the news in the last couple of months, but one of the ways in which these narratives are still very much present today is kind of a graffiti war, you could call it.
I heard about it.
So there is something, they call it a mural, but it's really just like a not very aesthetic rendering of Ratko Mladic, the convicted war criminal. And it is painted in one of the streets, which are in a central residential part of Belgrade. And over the last 8 months, different activists have tried to either throw paint on it or to somehow remove it in other ways. They have also tried the very legal, slow way of asking the municipality to remove it. They have the consent of the people who live in the building to do that. But anytime anybody touches it, a group that is really more like an army than anything else of young men, most of them were born after, very much after the genocide in Srebrenica, show up. They, on the one hand, they're very caring toward the wall and the painting, and they're very violent toward people who disagree with them. And
the police was also involved in protecting the mural, right?
The police stands on the side and does nothing as they threaten us. That we are speaking of young men who feel disempowered, and we have to have understanding for that, but that does not mean we need to tolerate it. And it is a situation that, without getting into a more serious debate at the level of the whole society over what it actually means, because there is part of what is going on is really gaslighting. We are being told that we shouldn't care about the past, we should look to the future. Who cares about one mural? At the same time, they're devoting an army to protecting that particular mural. And so there is a question of priorities. We are trying to gather public attention toward it. Other things that have happened are attacks against Women in Black, but also other organizations that work on these issues. There is hate graffiti painted on our doors. There are attacks against activists as they go back home after protests. There have also been attacks against women journalists in the last couple of months. So we are witnessing a surge of right-wing nationalist attacks. Mm-hmm. And they are happening with the agreement of the current government.
Yeah. And you've been involved now for how many years?
So 17, 18.
And what does it mean to you? Like you grew up As a girl in what was at the time still Yugoslavia, apparently you were not, you know, that much affected by the nationalism that you became a nationalist yourself. You managed to pull yourself away from that and try to make a struggle to make this nationalism, to weaken the nationalism and to weaken patriarchy. And now you see it rising again. That must be difficult. Or do you think, like, does it have to do with our strategies? Should we intensify the struggle? Should we change the struggle? Should we change our methods? How do you talk about that within the Women in Black?
Well, Women in Black are primarily a network. This is an ongoing discussion. Some of the methods remain the same. I think that in our exchange before, you were asking why the name Women in Black. And it is a decision, an appropriation of a traditional symbol. In the Balkans, as probably in many other parts of the world, people wear black when they are in mourning, when someone who is close to us has died. But in this particular case, it was a decision to make it a political statement and to wear black as a symbol of mourning for people who were killed in our name. And so to express solidarity and understanding for people from the other side, even though we personally might not see it as a different side, in recognizing the reality of war. When you ask me about nationalism, I'm really not sure that there is a formula or a simple explanation. I think that in itself, trying to resist the kind of one-way thinking that right-wing options offer is a struggle in itself. Sometimes it feels lonely. Sometimes there is a lot of questioning going on. I like to think that from time to time we do offer some answers and some ideas. When it comes to the question of whether we need to change strategies or intensify them, I would say we need to do both. Some of the strategies do need to intensify, but others, you can't stand by and look at things getting worse, even though currently, when you look at the whole world, that is what seems to be happening. And it isn't just one issue. There are new wars breaking out all over the world. There are ecological disasters happening. And we need to look at the whole complicated pattern and think about, on the one hand, how we are responding, but on the other hand, what kinds of actual alternatives we are thinking about and offering. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, some of the things that I can tell you, Women in Black very often organize street protests. When it comes to marking dates of certain war crimes from all over former Yugoslavia, those we mark by standing in silence in black, just with very, very, very clear messages, either slogans such as "Not in our name," or the names of, for example, cities that were attacked, or some other message. But also, Women in Black take to the streets, for example, to actually do proactive things. For example, Women in Black took part in a very large initiative to make conscientious objection possible in Serbia.
Is it possible now?
Yes.
Good.
It has been for a number of years now, but it is very interesting that one of the initiatives that the current government has is to bring back the army as an obligation for young men. The current Minister of Defense is trying to bring it back, is trying to make it mandatory for men to serve in the army for a year again.
Yeah. Well, what I was wondering is, like, do men use the possibility of conscientious objection?
Many of them did, yes.
Okay.
When there was an obligation to serve in the army and this became an option, many, many of them started to use it. Another thing that Women in Black do is actually try to record alternative histories. And one of the very important stories that they keep track of is the number of men who were actually deserters, who refused to serve in the Serbian army in the 1990s. And this is also an important part of history, not less in any way than keeping track of crimes, but also keeping track of resistance.
Sometimes nationalists would say to you, you have to let go of the past and look at the future. But Women in Black finds it very important to look at the past. And yes. Why is that?
It informs the way we think critically about the politics of today. One of the trends that we are witnessing right now is the rise of nationalism and warmongering on two fronts, on two issues that are simply not finished from the 1990s. One of them is the question of the status of Republika Srpska, the neighboring entity within Bosnia. And the other one is the question of the status of Kosovo. And basically with both of these issues wide open, people are actually not asking the right questions. They're not asking about the quality of life. They're not asking about where they're going to get a job. They're not asking about how they're going to organize their free time. They're actually just afraid of another war starting again.
Can you explain in short what these both issues are, the Republika Srpska and Kosovo?
Okay.
Or is that a very difficult question to summarize it? I mean,
I'm not sure I will do it justice. Unfortunately, so the end of the war in Bosnia basically came through the Dayton Accords, which made sure that Bosnia would be made up of these two entities, the Federation of Bosnia-Herzegovina, which where a majority the Muslims or Bosniaks and Croats live, and Republika Srpska, which is where the majority are Serbs. On the one hand, both of these entities are part of the state of Bosnia and Herzegovina. On the other hand, the Republika Srpska is actually, in fact, acting as if it was an independent country, and it is establishing ties with Serbia, with the nationalistic government that we have right now. Both of these governments are acting as if they have some right to actually still interfere in other neighboring countries. And in fact, most of their policies are actions where you can still see a continuation of the same policies that led to war during the 1990s. And what they are doing is in fact halting, first of all, any kind of real process which would help to establish responsibility of specific people for war crimes. But also they're just halting normal progress and any sort of story that where we would be talking about European integration, where we would actually stop, for example, as a country, as Serbia, where we would stop investing in arming ourselves even more and maybe invest more funds in, you know, things like education and healthcare and other mundane issues that where you can see the benefit only in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Kosovo?
That war took place in 1998 and 1999, and with the peace accords from July 1999, the Serbian army withdrew. We still have a dominant narrative in Serbia that says that this is a war that we have won. Even though in reality, when you want to travel there, you have to pass a line. The Serbian state calls it an administrative line. The Kosovo state calls it a border. And there are ongoing negotiations. In the year 2008, Kosovo declared its independence, and our state refuses to accept this. The issue that none of them are actually talking about is the well-being and quality of life of the civilian Serbians who are living there. And these are people who are basically left somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. But instead of opening that as a question, we keep going back to territories. We keep going back to issues which are actually, I think, in some way, they're not even supposed to be over. They're supposed to stay open and somehow remain as something that we can keep opening up and going back to over and over again.
And that's also to keep the nationalism alive, of course. It can be used very nicely, yeah.
And it's like a magic wand. As soon as you mention it, you are called a traitor. The dialogue closes, and that's it.
I was wondering at one side. I'm wondering, how do you, as a network of groups across borders, how do you make sure that such nationalist sentiments don't creep into your relations in the different parts of former Yugoslavia? On the other hand, maybe that's not a good question. Maybe I should ask, how do you try to focus within your network on the other issues that you find more important, like a good healthcare, good education? So maybe it's up to you. Which question would you like to answer?
So when we were talking about this interview before, and you asked me to single out something, I told you about the Women's Court, and maybe this is a great opportunity to mention that initiative. It started about 10 years ago, and in many ways it is still an ongoing initiative. It was actually a series of preparations and meetings, precisely the way you just described, with groups and activists from all over Yugoslavia, from all the different from all the countries that are now different, with women from many, many different backgrounds of different generations. What ties us all together is, on the one hand, that in many ways we were affected by the war, some of us in some ways, others in others. And through a series of consultations, we prepared the actual event of the court, which was a three-day event. It took place in Sarajevo in 2015. And women witnesses were actually given a public space to bear witness, to tell their stories, to talk about different ways in which war affected them. Some of the issues you can probably imagine easily, because we are talking about, for example, sexual violence, which always happens in war. We were also talking about the political background of the war, but we were also talking about how poverty affects us during the war and afterwards. We were talking about economic violence. We were talking about the problem of the existing legal systems, both in our countries but also internationally, where in the name of this balance, women actually have to face precisely the people who have hurt them the most. And this was actually an alternative justice system, a restorative justice system, which offered women a place where they didn't have to excuse themselves. They could tell their stories.
And they were believed.
Yes. And nobody would say yes, but nobody would ask additional questions. It was just a space for telling stories, and in the end for reaching a conclusion and for talking about what are our recommendations. The reason why I mentioned that this is still an ongoing process is because there is a documentary film which has been shown over and over again to many different audiences. The women who met as witnesses are still continuing to meet and support each other. They all come from different backgrounds, ethnic and otherwise. And this has been a space where they came together activists, not as victims. Pays attention to these stories when they involve attacks against us, but otherwise it is not really a story that that gets very, very much attention. It is usually just field work and activism kind of face to face with specific people that that is a space where we work. But yeah. The media, apart from a few journalists who have integrity, this is not something that gets actually reported on.
And is there something, I suppose these testimonies of the women have been written down, recorded. Is there something you want to do with that maybe in the future for a court for crimes that haven't been addressed yet? Or is it not meant to be used in an official judicial way?
If a court in the future decides to use this as a model, I think that all the women who participated in this would be very honored and glad that it does. But I think we are talking about a shift of paradigm completely. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that the idea would be to take these testimonies and then use them in a court the way the courts are organized now. I think that it takes a different frame of mind, a different approach, a different kind of thinking. And so if they're ready for that kind of change, dare I say revolution, that would be amazing. But if not, then I think it would just miss the point, unfortunately. It's something that activists can use. It's accessible through our website. If it's someone close by, we can organize a meeting and we can comment on the process that we went through. But otherwise, right now, I don't see another way.
Yeah, it's interesting because it can't really be used in the current judicial system because it's not suitable for that kind of testimony. Do you have hope that this will change, that this revolution will come, and where do you get your hope from?
Eventually, yes. My hope comes from education. I am very proud to be an activist to Women in Black, but my day job is with the Center for Women's Studies, and I organize various educational programs. I think that the best way to change the world is through learning and thinking. And I think that if we have a space where we can read and ask questions together and where we have the space to actually reflect and hear both the traumatic and sad stories, but also the stories of social and political change that came before us, I think that we can organize and we can do things better. The thing to keep in mind is that none of these changes come lightly. They take a lot of work and a lot of time. And they always ask the most difficult question, which is, what are you actually willing to do differently tomorrow than you did today?
Mm-hmm. And what is it for you? What is the most important thing that you have learned since your first days at the Women in Black, and what have you changed?
some of the things that I assumed when I first came were that these changes would actually be much faster, that we would just need to, you know, publish one text or give one lecture, and then why wouldn't people just understand? Because it just goes without saying that, you know, peace is better than war. The The other thing that personally I have learned is that it's okay that these changes take a long time, because if we were trying to do it too fast, we would actually end up sort of burning some of the bridges that we might actually need in the end. Mm. But some of the things, I'm not sure that they have, I mean, this is a question that you asked before, which was, you know, which strategies do we need to change? I think that some of the things we don't need to change, maybe we just need to amplify them. Mm-hmm. Maybe we still need to be activists in the street, but we just need to think about a way to attract more people to it. One of the biggest changes that happened around us, especially if I compare this moment to, let's say, the year 2005, when I first joined, is the kind of omnipresence of the internet and cell phones. And this is something that women in Black have adapted to. There is a very interesting video archive of street actions that they are keeping now, and that they make sure remains for other activists to be accessible, to be used for organizing and thinking in the future. And so some of these things are something that we maybe don't need to challenge or question, that we need to just keep and maybe amplify.
Mm-hmm. And Women in Black is a network, and it is in the countries of what used to be Yugoslavia, but it's more international than that. So I suppose international solidarity is important for the movement, right? Can you say something about it?
Crucial. Yeah. Yes. Women in Black in that name particularly exist in Israel and Palestine, in Spain and in Italy. But there are also many other international solidarity is crucial for our group. We keep in touch with many groups from all over the world, and express solidarity and accept help and support from all of them. And I was also glad to hear that activists from Kurdistan came to Serbia to visit Women in Black several years ago, and that some of our activists were in touch with them and offered the support that they could for their struggle. So this is something that we definitely share and have in common. And it is very important to keep in touch with the nuances and the complexities of different struggles all over the world.
Yeah. I was going to ask about Kurdistan, because Media News is from the Kurdish political movement in Europe. So there's actually some lines with Kurdish activists. Were you involved personally also?
Unfortunately, I wasn't, but my friends and other activists were. We can't always be all in the same place, but no, that was the struggle is collective. Yes.
Yeah. Very nice. And do you follow the Kurdish struggle or not that much? There's many struggles on the world, of course. So it's hard to keep track of everything. But is Kurdistan sometimes something that you read about or?
I personally, I don't follow it as much as I would like to. I know that there are big differences among Kurdish struggles. I know that women are doing amazing things in local communities in order to empower themselves. But unfortunately, I don't follow it day to day and in as much detail as I would like.
Well, thank you very much. It's very, very inspiring, I have to say. Very nice. You've been listening to Avashin Podcast, powered by Media News. Your host was Frederike Geerdink. The music you heard was composed and performed by Ulash Yashil. I would highly appreciate it if you shared this podcast on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or wherever you hang out online, so more people can find it. Thank you, and until the next episode of Avashin Podcast. And to Nadia, I would like to say Serkeftin, which is the Kurdish way to say May you be successful. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.